On the Empire podcast this week, Boyhood star Ethan Hawke drops by the pod booth for 5 minutes a year for the last 12 years. And we welcome the decidedly non-violent director of a most violent year, J.C. Jandor. All that and the usual movie news and nonsense on the movie podcast that really wants it to snow in London, but it's just not happening. There's never an Elsa around when you need one, is there? Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire podcast in association with Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, or online store. I've almost learned this bit off by heart now. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code EMPIRE. That offer code again, EMPIRE. Okay, so this week's two colleagues of such lethal cunning are a geek queen who's also an anti-monarchist, which is like 10,000 spoons when all you need is a knife. It's Helen O'Hara.
Okay, that isn't really ironic. It's just unfortunate. We've had this discussion about Alanis before, Chris.
I love Alanis. Next colleague is an online bigwig who's entirely bald, which is like a death row pardon 2 minutes too late. Hello, James Dyer.
Hello, Chris.
You've
stretched this Alanis metaphor, really? I think beyond irony.
I wrote the introduction, and by God, I'm sticking to it.
Fair enough.
Don't make me ad-lib. Bad things happen when I ad-lib. We've established
this. This is true.
Right, you've sent in questions this week. We've received said questions, gratefully. And here they are. This is one via email from Ross McKay, who says, "Hi, about to move to Australia." That's nice. Mm. Yeah, like the TV program Wanted Down Under.
Sure, Grand Designs Australia.
Ooh, that sounds good. MasterChef Australia.
Let's move on.
Okay. Had an argument at work. I insisted best film ever set in Australia was Finding Nemo. Interesting. Made me think, other than USA and UK, if you could only watch films set in a particular country, what country would it be? Now, no disrespect to Ross, but I'm ignoring his actual question. because I think I'm going to take issue with the first part of that. The best film ever set in Australia was Finding Nemo.
I think it's a credible argument, to be honest.
Okay, let's hear the credible argument.
Finding Nemo is great. Okay. It's set in Australia.
Right.
I'm convinced.
Let's move on. We're done. I'm going to say that it's a technicality.
It's not. It's Sydney's, you know, in it. If the Opera House is in it, that's totally Australian.
B, it's a cartoon, not a real film. I'm kidding. Jesus,
pitchforks. I'm going to set John Lasseter on you.
Pitchforks at dawn, everybody. There are better films set in Australia.
Like?
Well, the Mad Max trilogy, for one.
I knew you were going to say the Mad Max trilogy.
That was always where you were going with this. Yeah. He's not wrong, though.
He is wrong. I've watched the Mad Max trilogy recently.
Get me behind me.
Mad Max 2.
Yes.
Yeah. And yet.
Okay. Do you want more specifics?
No.
Wake and Fright.
Wake and Fright's good. Okay, fair enough.
Most early Peter Weir films.
Yep.
Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Yeah, I actually, you know, didn't love it first time I watched it. Like, it's all right.
Well, okay, look, recent stuff. Babadook.
Babadook was great.
Okay.
Muriel's Wedding.
The Total Recall remake. No, wait.
Oh, wait, no.
I'll be honest,
I've tried to avoid films set in Australia because I watched Wolf Creek and it scared me too much and I don't want to watch, because if that's what Australia's like, I don't want to go there. I don't want to know anything about it.
Because you're an Australianist.
I'm Australian. Some of my best friends are Australian.
The Proposition, another good one.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Lantana.
Listen, there are good films set in Australia, but you know, so far, only Finding Nemo is really a classic.
I'll see that and raise you Crocodile Dundee.
And, of course, Crocodile Dundee 2. Which inferts the plot of Crocodile Dundee, where he goes to America. But in Crocodile Dundee 2, he goes to Australia.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm saying any of those films. Animal Kingdom. But this is tricky because, yes, Finding Nemo is brilliant. But I don't think of it as an Australian film.
I know.
It's a film that just happens to be set for some reason.
It's set in Australia. It's not made in Australia.
Why then are there so few characters with Australian accents?
Because they're fish. Fish are international, man.
The entire film, though, is set in Australia, technically, because don't they live on the Great Barrier Reef? That's, you know, Australian waters. I'm saying the whole thing is Australian set. It's not like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not tenuous. Okay. It's fairly solid.
So where do they get their accents from? They speak with American accents.
Well, Jeffrey Rush is in it. He's a pelican.
And Eric Banner's in it, yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, but that's because those people just, you know, dubbed the original fish.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Of course, this makes so much more sense now.
The actual Nemo is Australian.
Okay, The Dish, another great film set in Australia.
I love The Dish. Actually, that's the best argument you've made yet. Absolutely adore The Dish.
Better than Mad Max 2?
Yes. A lot warmer, you've got to admit. Like, it's a lot nicer, and you come out feeling a lot more cuddly towards humanity after watching The Dish.
This is true. A lot of films set in Australia, as you said, make you never want to visit. I realise there are a lot of Australian listeners to this podcast, and in the past I may have offended you with my Australian accent, and I'm not going to do that now.
Thank God.
But you have a wobble board in your hand, Chris.
That's not a wobble board, James, and you well know it. But I will say that, you know, Australia looks fantastic, but it is also home to the 10 most venomous land snakes in the world. It has loads of things that can kill you, and I'm not even including Alf from Home and Away in that, who I walked past in the street once. I'm not sure that I would ever want to go there, because if the snakes don't kill you, then the spiders will, and if the spiders don't kill you, then it'll be like a kangaroo, it'll punch you in the face. And if that doesn't get you, then Mick Taylor from Wolf Creek will get you.
Mm. Yeah.
And that scares me. And I'm not sure that I want to do that.
I have been to Australia. Everything tries to kill you, even some of the sheep.
Really?
Yeah.
What were you doing to the sheep that made them want to kill you?
It's hard to say.
One last film. Because again, if we start listing films that are set in Australia or made in Australia, we'll be here all day.
Somersault.
Also,
that was a very good one.
Yes. Shine.
Also a great film. Yes, Howling 3.
Howling 3? Amazing.
That's extraordinary. Kangaroo Jack, of course, Kangaroo Jack.
No, of course.
The film that wins his argument, the best film set in Australia, Crocodile Hunter, Collision Course. So, Ross McKay, we've ignored your question, and I probably mispronounced your surname, but there we go. Let's have the next question now from @Obstacle3. First time this person's ever had a question asked on the podcast.
Ooh.
Yeah, the ones that, you know, I've never asked before always stand out to me. He or she asks, Roger Deakins just received his 12th Oscar nomination and has 0 wins. Who is your favourite Oscar non-winner? By this, of course, we mean people who've been nominated many, many times but have never won an Academy Award. So, have at it.
My favourite is perhaps the most fortunate or unfortunate of the lot, and that is Kevin O'Connell.
Mm-hmm.
Who is a sound mixer.
Yes, I Googled him this morning as well.
I knew him before, but I just couldn't remember his surname. Okay. But he holds the record for the most Academy Award nominations without a win. He's got 20. So he is, I think, indisputably, let's be clear-minded about this. He is at the top of his profession and then some. This is a guy who has serious sound mixing ability, but he has not yet If you want sounds mixed, get Kevin O'Connell, if you can get him. Pretty busy.
He's probably crying, to be honest.
But yeah, he's been nominated for, his first was for Terms of Endearment, where he lost out to The Right Stuff. In fairness, The Right Stuff has rockets and The Terms of Endearment has practically none.
Just so exactly.
He's always going to lose there. Yeah.
That's a criteria in which they work.
There are fewer rockets.
Well, you know, it's one of them. June, he was nominated for, lost to Amadeus. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to skip through them. Top Gun, lost to Platoon.
How do you lose to Platoon? Top Gun is a much better... I can't make that argument.
Well, but in terms of sound mixing, like when the planes go past each other and go...
Whoosh, yeah, lots of whoosh.
Lots of whoosh.
Like, and there's a significant amount of rocket in that.
And that should have... I would have thought that would help. But I guess Platoon also has kind of rockets. He was up for The Rock. He worked on Twister, Con Air, Armageddon, Pearl Harbor, Spider-Man, and Spider-Man 2. Chris, a favourite of yours.
Top sound mixing.
Memoirs of a Geisha, fewer rockets again, except for maybe the, you know, fireworks kind.
Mm-hmm.
Apocalypto, and his last one was in 2007 for Transformers, where he lost the Bourne Ultimatum.
It's hard to believe he didn't win for The Rock, which actually has rock it in the title, and a Rocket Man gag in the film.
I know, he really should have. On his last one there for Transformers, he said, if you could bottle up the way I felt this morning when I found out I was nominated, people wouldn't buy drugs anymore because this is just the best thing on the planet. So he maintains his sense of perspective and realises that he is doing extremely well.
I'm concerned that he hasn't been nominated since Transformers. I'm worried about him. I'm looking at the films he's made since Transformers, and he seems to he's gone into a different phase of his career. So he's worked on things like The Muppets, Muppets Most Wanted. He seems to be Jerry Bruckheimer's go-to guy for mixing sound. He's worked in Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time, The Sorcerer's Apprentice. All right, okay, so I think what we should do now is we should appeal to Hollywood.
Yes.
If you are working on an Oscar-worthy film, whether it's Oscar bait or not, if you think this has a chance of winning... little gold guy at the beginning of the year, please hire Kevin O'Connell. We need this guy to win an Oscar.
Hang on, he's on Pitch Perfect too. Job done.
Job done. Oh, hey, yeah. Helen, weren't you also on Pitch Perfect too?
That's right, I was. We should have hung out. Oh, sorry, Kevin. Anyway, he is my favourite because that is an astonishing line of work and, you know.
I want to know his mindset. I want to talk to Kevin O'Connell. I just want to, yes, he seems very happy about being nominated for Transformers, but 20 nominations and no win, you would probably, does he expect to lose now? Has he prepared a speech just in case it ever happens? You know, was he sad the first time? Was he sadder the 18th time? Does he cry? Does he think that, you know, maybe it's not validation of his efforts? Does he have a massively empty mantelpiece? I want to talk to him. Kevin, if you're listening, and I know you are because you work in the sound department, get in touch with this man.
That was a terrible gag.
People who lose, he has ears. So therefore, he's listening. Get in touch. Anyone else? Because so Roger Deakins has got 12. Thomas Newman, the composer, has 12. Alexandre Desplat, who has been nominated twice this year, has been nominated 8 times without winning. And every time they're in a category, Thomas Newman especially, he must look across and go, is Williams nominated this year? Williams.
Damn you, Williams.
Damn you, Williams. But yeah, 12 and 8.
Is it about the number of nominations, though, or is it just there are some people that it's inexplicable, like Hitchcock, who didn't win an Oscar? You know, it just kind of blows your mind. 5 nominations, no wins.
Mm. Yeah, sometimes you just don't understand what they're thinking. I mean, to be honest, I think nowadays they're becoming a little bit more aware of that. And sometimes one suspects they're giving somebody the Oscar because they should have given it to them 20 years ago. I mean, Jeff Bridges for Crazy Heart, it's a very, very good performance in that movie. But that film wouldn't have got the attention it got, I think, if he had won, you know, 10 or 15 years before. Julianne Moore this year for Still Alice, that's a film that made no impact whatsoever at the box office, really. It's, again, an incredible performance by her. But she's the front runner because she's been so consistently good for the last 25 years. Not because she, you know, this is a particularly stunning performance by her standards. Maybe the next time Kevin O'Connell or Thomas Newman is up for anything, they will win just because, you know, they should have won years and years ago.
True.
But Julianne Moore's exactly that. I mean, but you look at Sigourney Weaver, Amy Adams, you know, Johnny Depp, Tom Cruise, you know, obviously in Leo as well, you know, people who have been consistently snubbed at the Oscars. But weirdly, Kathleen Kennedy actually stands out for me. She's been nominated, I think it's, I want to say around 8 times, Lincoln's, Munich, E.T., Colour Purple, and other films, and never won.
Yeah, the funny thing is she produced Schindler's List, but she wasn't one of the credited producers as far as the Oscars were concerned, which is bizarre.
Must be kicking herself now.
I think she's doing okay.
You think? Yeah.
I think she's all right. Other people who've had loads of nominations but never won in the past, Robert Altman. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously there are honorary Oscars, but we're talking about people who were nominated for Oscars and never won. Peter O'Toole went 8 without winning any. Richard Burton had 7 nominations and didn't win any. It's certainly a theme throughout Oscar history. What I'm wondering now is, do the likes of Kevin O'Connell and Thomas Newman, do they diversify? Does Kevin O'Connell reinvent himself as an actor and come back and win in that category next year? What an inspirational story that would be.
That really would be.
That would be amazing.
I would buy the biopic rights right now for that.
Or you could, you know, maybe just make a live action short. Peter Capaldi has an Oscar.
That's true.
Because of a live action short. So Thomas Newman should write and direct a short and win next year.
Okay. Yeah. Well, good luck to them in those categories.
Or you could just start a Kickstarter campaign.
To buy an Oscar.
Not to buy an Oscar. You can, you know, although that wouldn't be too bad, but just, you know, please give me an Oscar. Please. That would be so nice. Thank you, guys.
I'm not sure that's how Kickstarter works.
No, okay, I never understand these things. Okay, thank you for your questions. If you wish to have a question read out in the Empire podcast, and why wouldn't you, do send them in via Twitter. We're at Empire Magazine, and use the hashtag Empire Podcast, or we won't see it. We're on Facebook as Empire Magazine, and you can email us, of course, at podcast@empireonline.com. Online, not magazine, empireonline.com. Okay, time now for our first guest. Boyhood started life roughly 12 years ago as a small indie film, an experiment that Richard Linklater must have thought would only be seen by a select few. Basically, it tells the tale of one boy over the course of his boyhood, and they shot it for about a couple of weeks every year for 12 years. Now, the movie could well be the Oscar front runner. Ethan Hawke, who stars as Mason's dad, also called Mason, in the film, came in recently to talk about the film as he hit the BAFTA trail, and he spoke to me and The Office's chief, Richard Linklater, and Ethan Hawke superfan, making her podcast debut, Liz Beardsworth. Enjoy.
We voted Boyhood our film of the year.
That's because you are intelligent. Because you have a brain in your head. And you're the best movie magazine in the world. So good.
It's an amazing film. It's such a beautiful film as well. But obviously, it was shot piecemeal over 12 years, roughly.
Of course.
This year, I guess, was the first year you didn't have to film anything for Boyhood.
Yeah.
Did you feel lost? Was there a period? Was it always the same period of time over the 12 years, the same 2 weeks?
No, never. I mean, if it had been that, it would have been like every Christmas or every... Yeah. It wasn't... you know, we would do it 1 year at Christmas, and the next year it'd be August, and then the next year it'd be March. It was never like 12 months. It would be 9 months. It would be, then my character wouldn't come up for a while. So it'd be 14 months for me. It was always, it was kind of, what as Dylan calls it, his never-ending tour. Well, this is Rick's never-ending movie. He was kind of always shooting it, you know, because he would shoot for 3 days, and then you'd hear about, oh, wow, a new Harry Potter book's coming out. Wouldn't it be amazing if the kids went to the Harry Potter signing? All right, let's get everybody together.
Yeah.
Let's do it. But that was only for a day.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And then you go, and then there were bigger ones where he would go, okay, Eller, I really want to do a scene around when you get your hair cut. So don't cut your hair for 2 years. I need long hair, and then we're going to shave it. And Eller was game, and he's like, all right, cool. And it was just, you know, and sometimes it'd be, okay, well, I want to do a scene at a baseball game. And actually, we got to get it this year because I want to get Clemens pitching.
Yeah.
And so we're going to do it 2 months from now. So they wouldn't. You know, it was always a...
Very fluid.
Very fluid.
Mm.
So there wasn't a period this year, for example, you were just walking around staring at the wall going, I should be filming Boyhood now.
You know, that'll be next year.
Yeah.
Because this year, the movie's been on our mind more than ever. I've never done so much promotion for a movie in my life because, first of all, positive that people cared.
Right? Yeah.
People want to talk about it, so
really
that's good.
It.
B, you know, we're releasing the movie through IFC. Which, I mean, this is now the biggest film of their history.
Wow.
You know, we've never... it needed a lot of love, this movie. I mean, they didn't have a... But, you know, if it had been Fox Searchlight or whatever, they could have put $20 million into P&A and the movie could do well. This is a tiny little distribution company that had the foresight to invest in the movie, right? I mean, who... I remember when... Rick came to New York. We had been talking about it for a little while, but he came to New York to try to raise the money for it. And it was how do you say to somebody, okay, here's a plan. I'm going to make a really weird movie, doesn't have a script. I'm going to cast an unknown actor who we can't sign a contract with because he's too young.
Mm.
But we're going to get him, we're going to shoot him for 12 years, all right?
Yeah.
And if you just give me a little bit of money every year for 12 years, I'll give you this weird 3-hour art piece, you know, and maybe you'll make your money back. People act like, oh, how did you guys do that? What if somebody died? What if you got in a, you know, lost your limb or whatever? The biggest miracle of the thing is that Jonathan Searing didn't get fired. You know, because these film executives get fired like, you know, I mean, they're a dime a dozen, these guys.
Yeah.
Right? And not only did he not get fired, but IFC stayed. I mean, Warner Independence gone. You know, all Miramax is gone. All the big little art house, you know, whatever you call those things, mini major.
The mini majors,
they're all gone.
Yeah.
IFC is still around. Now, they didn't have enough, you know, they got chump change to release a movie.
Yeah.
You know, they make Sony classics look like big spenders. And, so it required a tremendous amount of energy from Rick and Patricia and myself, and to a lesser extent, Eller and Lorelei.
Was paid off. Are you surprised at how much people are loving it? Or
I think I'm still in shock. You know. And so to answer your question, I think next year I'll think, where did the movie? I mean, I've been working on this movie for 12 years, and this is the 13th year, and I've worked harder on it this year than any other year. But yeah, I am, to answer your question, I am in shock about that people cared.
Lizzie interviewed Richard Linklater last week, and
here in London.
Here in London.
In this room, in fact.
This room. This is the Boyhood room. This is the Boyhood suite. They're going to rename it officially. And he was saying to you, Lizzie, wasn't he? He's begun to consider possibly, maybe at some point, continuing.
Well, yeah, he did say that. He said it's too soon to say for sure, but the 20s, he was saying, are very interesting, so if you were up for it, he might revisit these characters.
He could say that. I would make a case to be made that the sequel already exists, meaning that if you showed Before Sunrise, right, if you stop this movie and then you show Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, and Before Midnight, it's kind of the same character. I think in a lot of ways, Eller and I were... It's not the same, but it's certainly similar. I wouldn't, you know, I could see Mason Jr. taking the Ural just after college, meeting some French girl on a train. You know what I mean? You could make a case to be made that the films have a... There's a continuity there.
Does that mean that Richard would have to go in and, replace LR with you? In this movie, or replace you with LR in the Before?
Remake.
In truth, I've always said that what Rick and I were working on the Before trilogy is romantic love meeting time. And in Boyhood is a family meeting time. You know, we've kind of exchanged plot for time. You could continue on with Eller. You could do that. You could. There's no other moment of your life that works on such a specific grid, where time, like time, is first through 12th grade. It's got a beginning, middle, and an end. You know, and no other point in your life. The only other thing you could possibly do is do the exact same thing, exact same movie with Eller being the dad, and start it. With the day that Eller becomes a father. And it wouldn't be the same six, you know, then you'd see it from a different vantage point. You'd see fatherhood as opposed to boyhood, you know? And so, and then I could still be in it. Patricia could still be in it as the grandparents, but we would have a subsidiary, you know?
Oh, that's interesting, because I honestly thought that maybe you and Patricia would be lobbying Mr. Linklater to do this on a daily basis, like emails going, I miss that experience. I want that experience again. But you're not. You're saying wait 10 years.
I think that I was so moved by the end of the movie. The way that Rick ends the movie, I really do feel like it's finished. And I'm one of the few people, you know, I saw it 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. I watched the thing be put together. And I was the voice in his ear always whispering, you know, but how do you end this? Bastard, you know, you got to sail the ship. What's the point of it all? Why do we? And in the way that he resolved it, you know, and it's so beautiful. It's almost like an old-fashioned Western there with this very modern people. It's populated in this, you know, it almost looks like a John Ford movie. You know,
the light.
And so you're very aware of cinema, its relationship to time, and he, it's very beautiful. It's this like a little moment where he almost looks into the lens. You know, this is, it's the look at that final close up is very powerful, where it's almost we are him. And it's why I hesitate. People love the idea of continuing on, but that implies that the movie isn't finished to me. And the movie's done. I mean, we could start another movie if we wanted, but it would have to work as well, beginning, middle, to end.
Yeah.
That's the key to the Before trilogies, is you have to, I love it when somebody will say to me, yeah, but Before Sunrise is always my favorite. The other ones are okay and whatever. Or somebody will say, no, Before Midnight for me is my favorite. Before, because they all, you actually don't need to see the other ones. They work best if you have. But kind of like the Rabbit Run books or whatever. I mean, you can read any one of them. Doesn't matter.
Yeah,
I've watched them in the reverse order.
Have
and
you?
Actually, they work really interestingly
I
that
bet,
way, too. It's really
especially
moving to see them meet.
Yeah, I bet it is. And it's also cool because the way it starts, the way Before Sunrise starts, is with a 40-year-old couple fighting.
Yeah.
And so that's why when people ask if we're going to make more, a part of me feels like, I don't know, they might. They work so well as a trifecta.
Please make another one. I'm just begging you.
I have to admit, I did have, if Rick is talking about doing another Boyhood, I called Rick and Julie the other day because I was the one who felt certain we were done, and then about a week ago, I had a dream where Julie and I were watching the fourth film. And we were, I was sitting next to Julie in my dream watching the fourth one. And I, so I've, I saw images from it. I saw what it looked like, and I called Julie. Hooray. I was like, "Oh shit, it's on!" You know,
hooray!
Like, what?
Just made my day.
Can you shed a light on what you saw in
it
your dream?
It was really, really funny.
Yeah,
like it was a full blown comedy. So that it was really, really warm and funny, and that was a surprise because people anticipated to go to some even darker place.
Yeah,
the surprise was, what if it didn't? What if it went to some extremely light place?
That would be very, very...
Yeah. We're tearing a strip out of each other.
Yeah, yeah.
And breaking my heart. Speaking of the before films, because I'm slightly obsessed with them, are there any kind of scenes and ideas that got discarded from the first three films that you can remember?
Yeah, there's several. Yeah. There's been some ideas that have been discarded from all three films. We had to do a sketch... For whatever reason, you know, Rick's part of this thing of the Austin Film Society, and you know, they raise money for Texas filmmakers, and it's a great organization. When we were down there, we did like a little promo piece of Julie and I walking down the street in Austin, just a little thing, and we put it in this because it's been cut out of all three films. Is a monologue by me talking about Tolstoy's older brother, who was the real genius of the family, but lacked the necessary vanity to become an artist. But, you know, the idea that, you know, to really achieve great things, you actually have to be a pompous asshole. And this is this thing. And we put it in Before Sunrise and cut it. And we tried to put it in Before Sunrise and cut it. And we put it in Before Midnight and we cut it. So it's dead. It's definitely been not going to make the cut.
Oh, man, that seems a shame. There's a
funny speech.
Yeah. Is that something you believe, that you have to be a pompous asshole to achieve success? Or
maybe.
I've got to ask then. I've got to ask a follow-up question. Does that mean you yourself consider yourself to be, in part, a pompous asshole?
I'm definitely a pompous asshole. We all have... you have to fight it. You know, you have to fight the pompous blowhard that wants to roar up in every one of us, don't you think? I mean, that's not even a joke. Yeah. But I do think that all of us have that. What about me? You see it in kids so much, but me!
Sure. It must be tricky as well for actors, you know, writers, directors who get told on a daily basis by people like Lessett, you're great.
Yeah, well, and really, you know, I actually heard somebody speak on this better than anybody I'd ever heard before. It was Jeff Tweedy from Wilco.
Yeah.
Had a great thing he said, is that oftentimes you can mistake, they're complimenting you, so it feels like you're special. What they really mean is they love rock and roll.
Yeah. Mm.
Because I didn't invent the guitar. And I didn't invent these chord progressions, you know? And I didn't invent the act of coming to a stadium to see them. People come and they go, I love Wilco.
Yeah.
You know, what they mean is, I love rock and roll.
Yeah.
And then to which you can say, me too. And when people say they love Boyhood, to me, what they're really saying is, I love movies. Yeah. Thank God some movies are happening and movies are relevant and there's something new happening in the form. And, you know, and we're an appendage of that. But without you, the audience, without you writing about it, it's not important, you know? Without, you know, if there's so many things that went into Rick coming up with this idea, you know, you can't take Fassbender, you can't take Romare, you can't take these people out of his brain, you know? And without them, the movie wouldn't exist. And without Patricia, the movie wouldn't exist. Without Eller, it wouldn't exist. Without, you know, so Jeff kind of articulated it. I always think of that whenever you're like, yeah, I can let, because success is almost as hard to deal with as failure. Because failure at least inspires you to go, no. You know, when people ignore tape or something, when we work our heart on it and nobody cares about it and it can't come out and blah, 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 you're like, damn it. It inspires you to go, no, I'll do it better, damn it. Whereas success can't inspire sitting in your fat ass being pompous, right? But if you look at it like, no, actually, no. See, when people love Boyhood, they're saying they care about innovative cinema. They care about real people, and they care about a movie that doesn't have anything blowing up. And so it should inspire us to go, yes, yes, yes. So you can't, if you look at it like you're wonderful, then you sit on your fat ass. If you look at it like people saying, no, cinema matters, well then, then it's helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. Ethan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much, Ethan Hawke.
Lizzie B, our production editor, who makes sure we get the magazine in on time every month. Almost every month. I was 4 weeks late once, but anyway. Yeah, very, very cool.
Yeah. What a guy.
Yeah. No, Lizzie.
Oh, also
as well, yeah. No, Lizzie's very cool. No, she handled it well. She was a little bit nervous about interviewing Ethan. But yeah, that was very good. Enjoyed that. Right. Shall we have some movie news?
Let's do it.
I guess the biggest movie news this week, or this morning, the morning of recording the podcast, because I'm sure Hollywood will unleash something huge overnight, is the news of Simon Pegg. It's been a big week for Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright. Simon Pegg is going to co-write Star Trek 3.
Which will now undoubtedly be called Star Trek 3: The Search for Scott.
Undoubtedly. Undoubtedly. Where's he gone?
Hard to say.
It's hard to say.
Engineering somewhere. He's down, hiding behind the dilithium crystals.
He's down the shops. Do you have any amusing plays on You've Got Red on You? Any of the amusing lines?
You've got red shirt on you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that, which is possible because they could like explosively die. But we should probably talk about the actual news in this story, which is, yeah, the news that he'll be writing the film and he'll be working alongside confidence writer Doug Young. So they're taking over from, I think it was Patrick McKay, John D. Payne and Roberto Orsi, who were going to write the script. So I don't know if this is completely starting over from scratch or another draft of that that idea. Orki, of course, was also down to direct and is now out. Justin Lin is currently in the captain's chair, set to direct. But again, the plot is under wraps, as you would expect for anything even vaguely associated with J.J. Abrams.
There'll be stars and there will be trekking, I'm guessing.
One would hope. There's been remarkably little trekking in the last two films, actually.
They did seem to set up at the end of the last one that there would be more trekking in this one.
They did, but then they kind of set that up at the end of the first one, too.
This is also true. This is also true. I wonder if Benjamin Cumberbund will be back as John Harrison. As John Harrison in this one. Wouldn't it be amazing if everyone turned out in the next one not to be the people that you thought they were?
Wouldn't it be amazing if they all turned out to be Khan?
Yeah, well, I'm Khan. No, I'm Khan.
And so is my wife.
That would be so much fun. Thoughts on Pegg writing this? This seems like a good move.
It does. I mean, he's obviously, as we know, a very funny and a very smart writer. I would say he's probably at least as much of a Star Trek fan as anyone who's worked on the rebooted franchise to date. I think he knows his onions. And his dilithium crystals, of course. So I'm rather encouraged by this. I don't know much about Doug Young, who's going to be writing with him.
He's a confidence writer, you say. Does that mean he wrote something called Confidence, you're great. Keep on going. Yes.
How good would that be to have someone like that? Although that'd be enormously helpful as a writer if you had somebody in the background doing that. But no, he did write Confidence, which is the one with Ed Burns, sort of a
Rachel Weisz and Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah.
That one.
Con movie. So I don't really know much about him, but he could be the biggest sci-fi fan on the planet, and we just don't see it from his back catalogue. So benefit the doubt for now.
Again, yeah, it's interesting because Pegg, obviously, he has written things on his own. He rewrote the script for Run, Fat Boy, Run. But traditionally, he's worked with a partner, Jessica Hines on Spaced, and Edgar Wright on those three movies they did. I think we've mentioned it once or twice in the podcast.
Nick Frost on Paul.
Frost on Paul, indeed. And so it's going to be interesting. Is Doug Young someone that he really knows, or are they two people who've got an interesting take on the material who've been thrown into a room by Paramount? Also, we should point out, with a mandate to write the thing really bloody quickly.
Really fast, yeah. It's supposed to be out July.
Tomorrow.
tomorrow. July 2016. That is not a long time.
Yeah.
The world of modern blockbuster.
But this seems to be happening more and more. I mean, there was a revelation a couple of weeks ago that the new Bourne film, Bourne 4.
Yeah.
The fourth Bourne movie, there has not been another one since the Bourne Ultimatum.
Of course not.
That Greengrass and Paul Greengrass and Matt Damon and Greengrass's long-term editor, Chris Rouse, are writing the script as we speak. And that's out, I think, around the same time next year.
Next summer.
So seems to be like a seat of the pants element.
That one at least has, you know, more real world in camera stuff.
We don't know that.
Probably.
It could be Bourne Goes to Space.
It could be Bourne Goes, but ruling out the Bourne Goes to Space option just for a minute. It's yeah. more likely to be in camera. Yeah. Whereas this one, that for all we know, they've already started work on some of the effect sequences. You do get that sometimes when they're still rewriting the story, but they've actually got, they know who's going to battle who in space and are already working that up. So it may well be in deep in pre-production in that sense already.
Mm.
But yeah, it's interesting stuff. Apparently, Young got his job through a film called Diamond that he wrote for Bad Robot. But we don't know anything about Diamond either, so it doesn't give us anything more to go on. So we're just going to say Simon Pegg, yay.
Yeah.
Scotty for script duties. I mean, mm-hmm. Scotty can fix anything, right? So
that's the theory.
Exactly. So he can certainly sort out a script. I mean, easy.
Yeah. Is this a conscious tonal shift? That's my interesting thing from a Star Trek point of view. Because, I mean, if you look at the original 10 movies for Star Trek, you have fluctuations in tone. You look specifically at Star Trek's 9 and 4, and they are basically comedies. They're capers. So is this something that they brought him on board to turn into more of that kind of thing, to sort of, you know, shed a little bit more sci-fi and embrace a little bit more accessible comedy? Because 4, I think, is still the highest grossing of the original Star Trek films by some distance. Which is the one where they go, if you've forgotten, that's the Voyage Home, it's where they go back to Earth to find whales.
It's right next to England.
They find whales, weirdly, in San Francisco, which is obviously a curious place to look for it. But it's a comedy caper. It's all about fish out of water stuff. It's very, very heavy on the gags. 9 didn't do so well because it's funny, but it's also in-jokey.
It's also dreadful.
It's also a bit dreadful. Yeah. And there's F. Murray Abraham having a constant facelift. So, but no, I mean, I'd be interested to see what they do with this. I mean, the first two, certainly the first one, I think Star Trek, JJ's first Star Trek was quite, I thought, I won't say heavy on the comedy, but had good comedy chops. Mm. I think Into Darkness, less so. It's in the title, not surprising. This one, though, I don't know. Could it be a proper old
I don't know. I don't think Peg's been brought on to write Carry On Up the Enterprise.
Oh,
I thought I'd
quite
like that.
No, but it could be the, Star Trek 3, The Trouble with Tribbles.
It could be. That'd be amazing.
Yes.
That would be amazing. I'm intrigued. It could be a one-man play. It could be just Scotty in a room. They're really trying to cut down the budget, you know. But I presume all the cast are inked, as they say, on the trade papers to return. So, intriguing. We know nothing about it at this point in time, but we've talked about it for a good 10 minutes. So there'll be more of that as the year goes on. And speaking of things we know firstly nothing about, but it's related to Peg. Edgar Wright's new movie has finally been revealed. If you didn't know, there was a little bit of brouhaha, obviously, over Ant-Man. When he departed that project last year, there was lots of rumors. He's since been involved with a lot of things, from adaptation of a book called The Grasshopper Jungle. But now, this week, it was announced, or rather last week, it was announced that his new movie will be Baby Driver, which is a pure action movie about a hitman who listens to an audio tape and he has to undertake a very dangerous mission. And this is a pure Edgar Wright original.
An audio tape, not an audio book. He's not listening to Audible while killing people.
Yeah.
Is this literally a tape? Are we talking about a cassette here?
I don't know, to be honest. I'm just saying audio tape because that's what I say because I'm old.
It could be a podcast.
It could be a podcast. It could be this podcast.
It could be this podcast.
I'm meta with that.
It's almost certainly this podcast.
This one's intriguing because I've heard about this project on and off for the last couple of years, and it sounds like it could be amazing. There's a video Edgar made back in 2003 for the band Mint Royale. It's called Blue Song, and it features Noel Fielding as a sort of getaway driver, and it's 3 minutes, and it's just really visceral and really funny, and it's really, really good. And this seems to me like it could almost be a feature-length version of that. But I'm intrigued. Is this Edgar Wright, who may now be free of the shackles of a large studio, finally just going, right, this is what I want to do. This is going to be a visual treat. It could be like a 90-minute musical number. I don't know. I'm just guessing. But it could be, I'm expecting great action, great music. I'm really looking forward to it. And Ansel Elgort, who's an up-and-coming actor, has been linked with the lead role.
He's a good guy. We talked to him a couple of months ago, didn't we, for one of his films.
Divergent? Was it Divergent?
Fault in Our Stars.
We talked to him for the Fault in Our Stars, which was obviously a huge hit. He was one of, for me, the few bright lights about the dreadful men, women and children. So he could do something quite interesting with Wright, I think. I'm intrigued. I'm pretty much on board for everything he's done so far. So look forward to seeing this one.
Absolutely. Very, very exciting indeed. I'm looking forward to that one and looking forward to more details coming out about it over the next few months as well. And then there's a couple of other bits and pieces to round up. No real Marvel news this week, which long-time listeners to the podcast might be relieved to hear, although Anthony Mackie has said that Captain America Civil War will be like Avengers 3.8. I love that man. He's amazing.
He's great.
He said basically Captain America 2 was Avengers 1.5. This is more like Avengers 3.8. Which doesn't make any sense, but...
Nothing to do with movies, but also Marvel are turning all the comics on their head, which is kind of an interesting one. They're ending the current Marvel universe and combining it with the Ultimate Universe and a big Secret War explosion thing, which is happening in the summer. So, there you go.
Interesting. Now, we talked about this a little bit beforehand. This is an attempt by Marvel Comics to recalibrate their universe so it becomes a little bit more like the MCU. So, you know, the Fantastic Four are being slowly phased out, it seems, in the comic book world. And there are some cynics out there who suggest that maybe because Marvel Studios doesn't hold the rights to Fantastic Four, so they don't necessarily want them in the public eye as much anymore.
FU to FF.
Yeah. And they probably do the same with Spider-Man and X-Men if they could. But it's interesting, isn't it?
It is. I personally, from a comic point of view, X-Men is my absolute favourite line. X-Men, X-Force, all of that associated mutant stuff. So, frankly, if they stopped them, I would stop.
I don't think they would ever stop.
No, I know they wouldn't. And they wouldn't get rid of Spider-Man either, because he's too much of a loved character. So. Yeah.
Whereas Fantastic Four has perhaps dipped over the years in terms of its popularity. So
and Johnny Storm died, didn't he? Did they bring him back? Did he come back? I mean, they normally come back, but...
Everybody comes back.
Yeah.
Everybody comes back. Okay, so speaking of non-Marvel news and DC, Warner Brothers comic book related movie news, there was a big rumor this week that Ben Affleck's Batfleck would be appearing in Suicide Squad, which is the forthcoming David Ayer Dirty Dozen with supervillains movie with the all-star A-list cast. Yes.
Now this was, and again, cynically speaking, thought as a potential tee-up for another, for a Batman-Joker movie, wasn't it?
Yes, because we haven't had enough of those.
No.
Listen, this is still rumour, so we're discussing rumour, which is obviously unfair, etc. And, you know, the Marvel Universe has not always planned everything out in advance. If anyone tells me that Hawkeye was originally in that Thor script, I'll point at you and laugh. But at the same time, you know, this does seem to be making it up as they go along to quite a large extent. If they're sort of saying, oh, yeah, we're doing a Batman Joker film. Remember, we sort of said we were. Didn't we tell you that? We're pretty sure we told you that. We've been planning it for ages. It just seems a bit random. Like, where did this come from? Where does it fit in? What's happening? Who are these people? What's going on?
I'm sure it'll all be all right in the night.
I hope so.
As we all know, Helen, they planned from the very beginning for Batman to be a part of the Man of Steel sequel. So I'm sure that this is not, they're not winging it. That would be.
You're right. That's a silly idea.
That would be an irresponsible allegation.
It's like they won the lottery and died the next day.
So yeah, but I mean, Batman turning up in Suicide Squad, it's an interesting way to introduce your Batman, I guess. With a little...
He's already been introduced, of course.
Sorry,
by that point.
He has. Carry on.
Yep.
So this will be just after Batman v Superman : Dawn of Justice.
Yes, it will be. It will be just after that. It's not bad. I mean, because I think I said in the podcast a few weeks ago how I thought the idea of introducing Joker first without seeing Batman in any way, shape or form, that would have jarred for me. That would be, or Jared for me. But this is okay, I think. This means that I think this shows that there is a little bit of planning going on, even if it is kind of winging it, as long as they get something down on paper and they begin to have a little bit of a structure, a little bit of a framework.
I wonder about the whole, again, part of the rumour was that it was going to be sort of very close to the sort of Frank Miller-y take on Batman versus the Joker. And I kind of wonder how that will work, because I think some of his, some of his Batman Joker cartoons have been seriously, seriously violent and bloody and really quite tough reads. But at the same time, Batman movies, you know, you actually want 11-year-olds to be able to go and see them. So I wonder how they're going to work that out.
It is going to be interesting. But I wonder if in the DC universe that Warner Brothers are constructing, whether Batman and Joker have had history together, which I presume that they will have had by this point. But that's, you know, let's be excited about this, because it's, you know, Ben Affleck versus Jared Leto. I think we're all intrigued to see what his Joker is going to be like.
Sorry, that's Ben Affleck v Jared Leto :
Squee?
Squee.
Right, one last news story, and then we go to bed. This is... Jimbo, you got a printout here.
I do have a printout,
This is news that Kaya Scodelario, formerly of this podcast, may be in Pirates 5.
That is literally the extent of the news, yes.
Great, let's move on.
K. Scodelario, or K. Scodders, as she goes by on Twitter, may indeed be in Pirates 5, playing a person.
That's good. You excited about that?
I'm very excited that she's playing a person in Pirates 5. Maybe it's not a person. It could be a monkey. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Probably not.
Yeah. And what do we know about Pirates 5 so far?
Well, it's the fifth in the popular Pirates of the Caribbean saga.
I love when you do extended reading around subjects. It's great. It really shows.
Yeah. Well, what do we know about Pirates 5? Let's have a look.
This is a new feature in the podcast called James Googles in real time.
No. We know Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No, Tell No Tales. Dead Men Tell No Tales.
Yes.
2017, I think it's out. July 2017.
2017, yeah.
It's currently what it's looking for. And that's pretty much it. Jeffrey Rush is going to be in it. Obviously, Johnny Depp's going to be back in it. I think Javier Bardem, Christoph Waltz also connected to that as well. Orlando Bloom also might return.
Interesting.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
It is interesting. And
it's in talks. That's not confirmed.
Brenton Thwaites of...
I'm Brenton Thwaites.
Yes. Who's an Australian actor who's very good in Son of a Gun, less good in Maleficent. But he's apparently in talks to play a dashing British soldier. So he will be the Orly of this one, if you will. Orly having graduated to be man Orly as opposed to pretty boy Orly. I don't know. I'm not sure where I'm going with this.
So they're saying he's young Orly. What?
He's like the young, handsome one. So Orlando Bloom is like the slightly older, handsome one.
Okay, so he's not playing young Will Turner.
No, sorry, I was confusing you.
Okay. Because Orlando Bloom, it doesn't look like his age today. He could still play young Will Turner and old Will Turner at the same time. If they wanted to do a Days of Future Past thing, that'd be interesting.
Would it? Yeah. Okay, yes. Yeah.
The question perhaps that drives this is there a big appetite for Pirates 5, do we think?
Well, the last one, despite being absolutely rubbish, grossed over $1 billion. So yes. Yes.
At least in the studio, yes.
Part of me would have maybe stopped by now.
I'm intrigued by this one. The directors intrigue me.
The Kon-Tiki directors.
Norwegian directors of Kon-Tiki, Joachim Ronning and Espen Sandberg. And apologies once again to our Norwegian listeners for mangling those pronunciations. but they intrigue me. I think this could be okay. The worry for me is Johnny Depp, Jack Sparrow burnout. There seemed to be an awful lot by the time of the last film. People were going, oh, not first time the movie came out, first one, people, oh, what a breath of fresh air this performance is. Who knew Johnny Depp could be so cookie and off the wall? And then by the fourth one, it's like, oh, God, not this guy again.
Well, we're going to talk more about Johnny Depp in a little bit. But spoilers. I think that's a genuine concern. I will say also the directors, who I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce, they also made Marco Polo, which I've been watching recently and which is very good. The TV series Marco Polo. And it's really, really entertaining. So that gives me some hope as well.
Is this a good move for them, you think?
It might be. If they can bring some of the fun and also the weight that they got into Marco
Polo
into Pirates, I think that could actually be what it needs. It needs to have a little bit of heft again, because the last one just didn't feel like it had anything to it except people clowning about and mermaids.
Very much so. Mm. So you think this is a good career move as opposed to the good advice that they just didn't take?
You set that up. Like, it's the joke that keeps on giving.
This is amazing. Your knowledge of that song's lyrics are astonishing.
I'm playing the long con on this, yeah.
My word.
Like the old man who turned 98.
Yes, just like him.
It's like a black fly in your Chardonnay. Really is.
Can I just say very quickly before we leave news that I'm very excited about one other story, which is TV, not film.
Mm-hmm.
But J. Michael Straczynski is going to adapt Kim Stanley Robinson's Red Mars trilogy for TV. That is amazing. That is proper hard sci-fi. That basically Kim Stanley Robinson sat down and thought to himself, how would we terraform Mars? And then answered it. And that's an absolutely incredible series of books. Really, really sciencey science fiction. With some very, very good characters as well. But that's a really interesting thing. So hopefully that will happen. It's up with US's Spike network.
And J. Michael Straczynski, for people who don't know, is?
Is the guy who created Babylon 5, which James and I at least like. Well, I like. Fuck it. James can naff off if he doesn't.
Yeah, you can naff off, naffer.
Yeah.
Babylon 5 is a big pile of shit.
Yes,
get out.
Well, we've all heard that, or at least I've heard it a lot since.
Now, it's interesting, Callum. You quite enjoyed Babylon 5 at university, didn't you?
No, we're moving on.
Babsock, was it Babsock that you joined at university?
I think we may have discussed this in the podcast once before, but for listeners who haven't.
Fine.
That's going. This is. Yeah. Helen?
Yes.
What is Babsock and how were you a part of it?
When I went up to university, I didn't have my own TV because I was not fancy. and there was only one shared TV in the sort of the university common room. And it was at the time when Babylon 5 Series 3 was on, which we can all agree was an amazing series that everybody needed to see. So I obviously had to get hold of it somehow. And to do that, I joined something called the Babylon 5 Society, or BABSOC for short, just to watch the show. But I was horrified the first time I went because, the show finished. And then they turned off the video in those days and said, right, and started discussing it. It's like, I don't want to discuss it. That's a bit nerdy, isn't it?
Mm.
I'd rather just come to BABSOC and watch the show, like
and
a non-nerd.
This all happened while you were dressed up as a Minbari.
I was not dressed up as a Minbari, but I perhaps should have been. Anyway, he also wrote Thor, and he's written some amazing comic series as well. If you haven't read Rising Stars, I highly recommend it. But this is a really interesting adaptation.
At university, I joined something similar, actually. It was a big Star Trek Next Generation fan in university, and I joined a society that was dedicated to Worf, basically. And the society was called Worf, a New Kind of Klingon Society, or as we called it, Wanksock.
You're so proud of yourself for that one.
You have no idea. You have no idea the mental arithmetic I've been doing. While you were talking, it was just, talk longer. I can do this. I can do this. I can bring it home. I apologize to all our listeners for that joke. But anyway, that's the news. And now here's Ali Plum with the science bit, because this podcast is, of course, brought to you by Squarespace.com. And here's Ali to explain exactly what that means.
Hello and welcome to the science bit of the Empire podcast, where Ali, the editor, that's me, tells you a bit more about our sponsor, Squarespace, and how to make use of their free trial and discount deal. If you're not already in the know or missed Chris saying it earlier, Squarespace is the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com and use our offer code EMPIRE. That's one word, EMPIRE. Here are a few more reasons why you might want to use Squarespace. For starters, Squarespace is very easy to use, as well as being user-friendly and doing all the tricky stuff for you. That's search engine optimization, hosting and making your site mobile, tablet, portable device friendly. For starters, they've also got a huge vault of pre-prepared designs and style options for you to be getting on with and then tweak to your taste. If you sign up for a year, you get a free domain name and you'll enjoy an on-hand support team working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. All for $8 a month. You'd have to change that into pounds, obviously, if you're from Britain. With, as mentioned earlier, a free trial and 10% off your first purchase with the Empire Podcast's very own offer code, EMPIRE, via squarespace.com. Thank you for listening. Here is the rest of the show, which will seamlessly start again now.
Okay, it's time now for guest number two on the podcast. We had Chasey Chandor on the podcast around this time last year for the brilliant All Is Lost. He doesn't hang around because he's back again with A Most Violent Year, an 80s set New York crime drama which stars Oscar Isaac and Jessica Chastain. As a married couple trying to make their way as entrepreneurs at that time, but they're beset on all sides by dickheads and circumstance, essentially. Phil Dissemblian and I spoke to Chasey when he came to London recently.
Delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by Chasey Chandor, director of the fantastic A Most Violent Year. You're 3 for 3, sir. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. The goal is just to keep getting invited back. I wish it was a more noble purpose than that, but I just want to keep being able to tell these stories. So I'm very glad people, at least in this first wave, seem to be understanding what I was trying to do.
And what you seem to be doing so far as a director, because you have Deepwater Horizon coming up, which is going to be a huge, epic... I'm not going to call it an action movie, but it will have action.
Well, it is. I mean, there's part of that, certainly.
This movie is the complete opposite of All Is Lost, which was itself the complete opposite of Margin Call. We were talking about how, in a weird way, I mean, Sidney Lumet is a name that's bandied around in relation to this movie, but... you're kind of almost a modern-day Irwin Allen. These are almost disaster movies.
Someone the other day pointed out that that the sort of wides in this movie, which like I almost started crying when they said this because I was so excited, but the wides, there's an opera to it, right? Like to this guy. He's so self-serious in the way he kind of presents himself to the world. And so they were noticing that there was like a Kubrick element, which was the first real director. That's not fair at all to say. Not the first real director. But the first person I figured out what a director did. I was like 15, 16 years old, and it was by looking at Kubrick's movies, right? And I was like, oh my God, I see what a director does. Before that, I'd been just sort of wrapped up, you know, Spielberg for me was like right when I came, you know, into the movie world, and I was being, you know, taken on that journey, but I didn't really knew what he did or anything. And so that was a wonderful compliment that there is that there's certainly supposed to be a sort of opera, you know, in the tradition of gangster films, obviously, going all the way back to the 30s. You know, the film follows these signposts that are, you know, a cash transaction at the front, the femme fatale. I mean, if you look at the first image in the movie of Jessica, she's literally sitting at a mirror brushing her hair exactly the way the woman, you know, is almost always introduced in those old films. So, you know, I'm following this sort of roadmap, but obviously trying to take you on a little different journey as it goes along.
Yeah, I was wondering, I mean, there must be, is it like trying to get through a minefield of cliches, you know, when you're in this country, because in this sort of terrain, and it didn't, and I say that because it felt fresh and it didn't feel like it was going near those, but you know, the idea of the sort of Lady Macbeth figure behind the powerful man and the
I mean, the way I've sort of, you know, this movie started as two ideas. It was this sort of, I mean, I've used this phrase before, but it's like, you know, like in the Wild West, the tumbleweeds that roll down. So I've learned my writing process is basically, you know, I don't even have to write anything down, and it's very sort of complicated and frustrating, and hopefully I won't get hit by a bus and not remember it. But there'll be two or three scripts rolling down the street at any time, just picking up ideas. So you guys on the way out of the room will do something. I'll be like, oh, let me just. That sort of connects itself to an idea.
Right.
So I was like 7 years or something into this married couple that was building a business together. You know, why does the one butcher stop on the street kind of say a nice quiet butcher shop, right? And then the one at the other end of the street becomes, you know, what's your guy's big supermarket, you know, Tesco or what is it called?
Sainsbury's or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So like, that those two family-run businesses, like because of ambition and all that crazy stuff, like exploded in different ways. And who's to judge where happiness is or anything else? But they just did, right? Like, and so I was looking at that, and then kind of collecting ideas for that from all different fun people. And ideas from different places, and then basically needed a job. I had written Margin Call and had shot it, but no one had seen it yet, and I was like broke, and I have a family, and like, so I was out looking for writing jobs. And then kind of a year later, people saw Margin Call, and then I start getting offered directing jobs, right? Yeah. That are just like the run-of-the-mill kind of business. So partially because of what my strengths are as like the like thrillery kind of thing that I did with Margin Call, it makes sense. But the overwhelming like 80 or 90% of the sort of raw material, books, you know, ideas, articles, this, that, were sort of, you know, gratuitously violent, right? You know, that I was getting. And that's just interesting to me as a filmmaker, right? Because it's like, that's what these people want to make. And you sort of look at all the different reasons as to why that is. And some of them are totally legitimate, and others are laziness. And, you know, I mean, it's a very visual thing. Films are cut, countercut, cut, countercut, cut, countercut. You know, you want something to be drawing your eye around and your action around. And so that threat of violence or gunplay or even swordplay, you know, it's great on film. It's fun to watch, you know, obviously. So that's one reason. But then the other is, you know, when it doesn't try to achieve anything original in its actual storytelling, it sort of veers into something else, in my humble opinion.
There's that Chekhov thing of if you have a gun and if you find a gun on the wall in the first act, you know it's going to be used in the final act.
Exactly.
And there is a gun in the first act.
Yep.
You can't talk about whether it gets used in the third act, but I mean, those things that are
but
in your
mind. So I start to look at all that, right? And I'm like, what I've done successfully up until this point, because I watched all my movies in my 20s, like I literally, that's when I did, you know, I'd start with the first film of a director and watch the whole way through. And I wasn't getting hired to do much else. So I sat around and watched, you know, pretty much every movie that I could get my hands on. But since then, I then had a kid and then started, you know, 5 years later, started to actually get some work finally after 20 years. And so I've realized when I'm writing, it's not so much as a director, but as a writer, it is much better for me to kind of be writing from the memory of all those films that I saw. A lot of directors I love go back and they'll watch every classic within a genre they're about to attack. I think the weird thing is by not doing that as a writer, it's allowing me to kind of, you know, skate right up to them, you know, but in a, but hopefully, you know, Jessica's character, there's obviously a lot happening there.
Yeah.
You had an incredible ensemble cast for your first movie.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Jeremy Irons, Kevin Spacey, Paul Bettany.
Oh, jinx.
Demi Moore. No, I mean, fantastic. And I understand, you know, that it was very much a kind of on the hoof. There's almost like a school play atmosphere because you were changing. Behind the sets. And
yeah, that movie was shot in 17 days. So we were all there at the same times, like literally. And it was all shot on mainly one floor of a really big skyscraper. So the there were no trailers or anything. Everyone had a little office as their space. And then the sets were intermingled within those little offices. Mm. So we were literally all just, you know, there, you'd be shooting one of those scenes in the corner thing. And then next door, like Spacey and Demi Moore would be hacking a butt. I don't think she smokes, actually, but he'd be hacking a butt, you know. And you were like, for a first-time filmmaker, it was like, what the heck is going on?
You're like, it's non-smoking, Kevin.
Yeah, exactly. I can promise you, no one said that. We let him smoke anywhere he needed to.
I love it, especially for Jeremy Irons.
Yeah,
he flies out of the night sky as the head of this bank, like a vampire. And you can see him being almost like the legitimate face of the Gruber family, like the diehard sort of vibe. And there's this great boardroom scene.
Yes. That scene, you know, I sort of wrote the opposite of that scene in this movie, which was in that it was that was filled with all this flourish. Right. He got to come in and sort of the key to that scene is he's actually literally doesn't want the words to be coming out of his mouth. So he's using Zachary Quinto's character as like his mouthpiece, because he's collected enough of the board there that like he can get the word out. And he basically wants, he's like suckering this kid into being, you know, he damn well knows he didn't get up out of bed and fly there if he didn't know what was going on. So it's so beautiful because he's there kind of, I mean, that was the craziest rehearsal on planet Earth. And then in this movie, Oscar and I actually fought a little bit over it. There's the scene, obviously, which is right out of a sort of classic gangster film where the families gather around. And what I did there is the exact sort of opposite, which is Oscar arrives at that moment and can't, it's sort of so human, but like doesn't have a big, big speech or anything. All he can literally say is stop, you know, and which is more of a kind of human plea than anything else. But those scenes, there's one in this next thing that I'm doing that I didn't even know about, and I just found out that this meeting had actually happened. I mean, you cannot make this stuff up. It's like, so anyway, I love those scenes. Whatever you do with them, it's great actors gathered in a room, and as long as the sort of room feels expansive enough, and then the world is sort of represented in it. It seems like a really interesting place for me.
You've talked about this obviously quite a bit, including in an interview we did for Empire magazine. But Javier Bardem was originally connected to the movie, not necessarily signed on, but
yeah.
And he obviously he's older than Oscar, and he would have brought a different tone, a different timbre to the film.
Yeah, it was. I mean, he and I had a wonderful couple months, kind of going back and forth over the thing. But he, you know, he's a very passionate guy, and if you know, if he walked in the room, I'd give him a big hug. You know, but he wanted the story to go in a little bit more of a sort of, you know, black and white kind of way, and my filmmaking and writing just sort of isn't best in that place, and so we kind of agreed to disagree, and it was difficult, but it was what it was. And then I was looking at other older actors, actually, and Jessica, you know, after that, because I was like, who else, you know, is that? And then Jessica started talking to me about this kid from Juilliard that she went to class with, who was a year or two behind her, and so they had never performed on stage together, but they were actually, but they'd done classes together, and they were actually good friends. They had shared, you know, a girlfriend of or boyfriend of hers was, I think, a good friend of Oscar's, and so they really knew each other well. And she starts pitching him to me at Cannes right as I had gotten back from a meeting with their friend, and I was like, I don't think that's going to happen. And she starts this great, you know, she's like, well, his mother is Guatemalan, his father is Cuban, he grew up in Miami, he literally got himself into Juilliard, which is like our best, you know, I shouldn't say best, but it is one of our great conservatories for acting. And so he got into like an open audition. I mean, it's like, it is the American dream. This guy's like a, and then on top of it, once you start to look at his work, it's, you know, he's like a a Stradivarius, man. That guy is finely tuned, and it's awesome to, you know, he and Jessica together having that trust because they had known each other for that whole time and come up in the same sort of form of training. And like, so they kind of ripped this script apart, rebuilt it in their own minds, you know, and created these characters, which is all you could, you know, ever hope for.
Before we let you go, which I think we have to do in the near future, A Deepwater Horizon. You look at All Is Lost's IMDb page, it has obviously just Robert Redford's name.
Yeah.
You look at the IMDb page for Deepwater Horizon, it just has Mark Wahlberg's name.
Yes.
Have you told him he's playing all of the parts?
No, there are, that is a, that people? Is very different than All Is Lost. That is literally a cast of, I cannot remember the exact number, but it's 126, I believe, of the survivors, plus the 11 individuals who lost their life, plus this amazing support sort of system around it. So that will be a cast of 170 or something. But it is, it looks like that movie. I mean, you know, of course, it'll famously blow up tomorrow morning now that I'm saying this. But they, I knocked on wood if anyone's listening to this.
I think this is for Micah. I'm not
but
sure.
Yeah, oh, great. Thanks. Okay, then I'm now going across the room.
There we go. That's
So, but that movie, they're digging the foundation for the set right now. So that movie is pretty much a go, and it's a fascinating opportunity where. It's I don't think it's going to come out in the summer. I'm not sure exactly when they're going to release it, but it is a huge blockbuster budgeted film, but about this very contemporary kind of event. And I feel honored and humbled. You know, we don't make a lot of movies like that at that scale that are sort of about, you know, real events. But if you wrote it, no one would believe it, I think is the best way. That story, the more I learn about it, it's, you know, it's as if it's this sort of tragic poem, basically, about our position with oil. We need it, and we know that, and so you can't blame these people for working hard to get it, because we're the ones using it. I am, at least. You realize when you sort of see what we're going through to pull it out of the earth at this point, and the amazing kind of human intelligence and effort and everything that's needed to do it. You know, no matter what your political persuasion, like, we're running out of the stuff. Let me just tell you that if this is what we have to go through to get it, you know, we should start looking, you know, for something else because you know, it's fascinating. So it's about these brilliant people who get wrapped up in, you know, in sort of a very intense situation. So it's very much part of the overarching thing. I think I'm trying to write a kids movie right now in my head I have young kids, and I'm sure it'll still come out where the poor kids are in crisis, but it'll hopefully be something that they can at least watch. But no, it's an amazing opportunity, that movie.
A disaster movie set in a playground, perhaps.
Exactly. The swing is squeaking.
The two chocolate bars thing. We could do that again. We're just, there's a bunch of kids fighting over chocolate.
That's
bars.
What I think I'm just gonna do 8 people silent sitting in a room. You know, just take the Redford theme, you know. But well, thank you guys. I'm a big fan of this. I listen to these things, so it's really cool to be a part of them.
Thanks very much indeed, JC
Chandler. Thanks very
much. Thank you. Pleasure, man.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Okay, let's start the review section now with A Most Violent Year. That's a segue seamlessly from JC Chandler into the discussion of his new film. Helen.
This is Oscar Isaac as a Latino immigrant, a self-made businessman, Abel Morales, and his wife Anna, who's of course played to Oscar-nominated effect by Jessica Chastain, and they're basically at a sort of make-or-break moment. They risk everything on this one deal, but everything is kind of conspiring against them. So it's not quite a year, actually. It's sort of set over a much shorter period. I thought about a few months, or 4 months.
Yeah.
But it's in 1981, so it has got that kind of period feel to it. It makes it a little bit more, it feels a little bit more lawless than it otherwise would be. And he's basically selling heating oil. He's one of a number of rival independent sellers who sell directly to householders, buy from these big businesses. But he's trying to buy land to expand his operation, and that's where, you know, everything kind of centers around. Mm. So you've got this couple really under pressure in the middle, but equally soon exerting pressure outwards as well, and really forcing other people to come around to them.
Yeah, this is do not be fooled by the title. It's ironic. like Mr. Play It Safe, who refused to fly. And then when he did, the plane went down and he thought, isn't this nice? This is... How do we get started in this?
Do we have to pay Alanis Morissette for this egregious butchery of her lyrics?
I think we may have to. This is not a violent movie. Don't go expecting lots of gunplay. Do not go expecting lots of car chases.
Yeah.
Although, having said that, it has one of the best car / foot chases that you'll see in a very, very long time in this movie. But in this movie, guns are a real thing. Guns are a very, very dangerous thing. And this is about one man who is trying to plow a very straight furrow in a world where everyone around him is a crook of some kind. So it's not quite like The Godfather, where you have Michael Corleone, who's trying to go straight, but he is continually dragged back into the world.
Yeah.
This is about Oscar Isaac, who is, this probably goes without saying, fantastic in this movie. It's about him just trying to stay on the straight and narrow and trying to do the right thing. And trying not to give in to the pressure that bears on his marriage and on his business.
And it's interesting, actually, the sort of dynamic in the marriage, because, of course, she's meant to be a gangster's daughter.
Yes.
So she is a lot more willing to bend the rules.
Yeah, she's very happy to go to the mattresses.
Yes.
And he is absolutely not. He's adamant that will not happen. He doesn't want to take help from anybody. He wants to get out of this hole that he's in through no fault of his own. He wants to get out of it by himself. And it's a really, really compelling drama. In the rare moments of violence, it does pack a punch. But this feels like such a, well, for me, a really, really wonderfully lived-in drama. It reeks of the atmosphere of early 80s New York, which, as J.C. Chandler explained in the interview, it was only the second most violent year in New York history. But it takes place this wonderful snowy time. It's very, very cold. The tones and the colors in the movie are very subdued. But this is great. I think J.C. Chandler is absolutely fantastic. Yeah. I think he's the real deal. Margin Call, I loved. If you haven't seen it, it's a very, very talky drama with an all-star cast about the financial meltdown. It's absolutely brilliant. And again, All Is Lost was one of my films of the year in 2013.
Yeah, terrific.
Brilliant, brilliant film. All these movies are about men and women being put under incredible pressure over a specific period of time and how they rise to meet those challenges. I think he's fantastic. And this movie was overlooked for the Oscars. That's kind of okay, I guess, because you can only have five nominees in each category, but the performances in this are fantastic. From Chastain, from Oscar Isaac, David Oyelowo, who's brilliant as a DA, who's ruthlessly just hounding him down. And all the way through, it's one of those movies that's just filled with character acting gold.
Those three in particular, if they don't have an Oscar in the next 10 years, something's gone horribly wrong.
Yeah, I think so. I think X-Men Apocalypse could be the one that really...
Does it
think,
for Isaac?
I think so. It's 4 stars. 4 stars then for A Most Violent Year. It is fantastic. Go and check it out. Is it the best film this week, though? Is it even the best Oscar Isaac film this week?
I'm not sure. This brings me back to the day, George Mackay Day in October 2013.
October 4th.
Yes.
Well, I will never forget it.
What a day.
I will never forget it.
But there are indeed, yes, two Oscar Isaac films out this week, because the second is Ex Machina, and it is bloody terrific.
Mm-hmm.
James, do you want to lead this one or shall I?
Ex Machina.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can do this.
Okay.
This is Alex Garland's directorial debut, science fiction film starring Donald Gleason as Caleb, the computer programmer who wins a competition at work to go and spend a week at the home of his sort of reclusive, Steve Jobs-esque founder of his company. Mm. And he flies, played by Oscar Isaac. And he flies out there and is introduced to Ava, played by Alicia Vikander, who is an android. And the whole thing sort of takes the form of a Turing test where he has to probe this android and ascertain whether or not she is a believable AI or not. But of course, everything is not quite what it seems. And life, of course, has a funny way of helping you out when you think everything's okay and everything blows up in your face. Alanis aside, it's a really nice film, actually. It's wonderfully directed. And I love the set design for this. It all takes place in this very sort of... you can imagine this is what Steve Jobs' house actually looked like, where it's this sort of underground bunker and there's waterfalls. It's very feng shui. None of the doors have handles. It's all sort of computer operated and slightly sinister. Although all the doors do seem to be open with slightly strange laser-etched key cards, which seem rather low tech by comparison. Mm. Anyway, I digress. Oscar Isaac plays the role very, very sort of in a sort of very sort of sinister mentor role. Like he's always hungover, drunk, beating the hell out of a punch bag. He's very big in this movie. You know, really sort of buffed up. Mm.
With a big beard and a bald head.
Yes, he comes across as a very threatening personality, complete opposite to Donald Gleason, who's obviously very gangly, very thin, and very, very sort of disarming and likable in this, somewhat diffident. But the high point of this, I think, is the two relationships, the relationship between Caleb and Oscar Isaac's character, and of course Caleb and Vikander. And she's probably, she is the standout in this. I think she's fantastic as Ava. She gives that real sort of blend of slightly vulnerable humanity and very sort of deliberate robotic mannerisms. Mm. And the effects work is really nice. There's that sort of, she wears that suit where you can see her abdomen glowing through. And it's really nice. So the relationship builds between them, and he kind of falls for the incredibly hot android girl. Not a huge surprise there. You know, fembot, if you will. And then it becomes a point of who's questioning who, who's exploring whose humanity. And to say any more would ruin the film. But very, very well done. Very, very good. I highly recommend people see this. It's not a fast-moving science fiction film. I think it's much more thought-provoking, much more cerebral than that, but it's a lot of fun.
But it is very gripping, like because you're never quite sure where your sympathies should lie, because they keep you guessing. I mean, it's a chamber piece. It's literally those three plus one other person, and I guess at the beginning there's a helicopter pilot, but that's it. Mm. That's your entire cast. So it's really, really focused on them. You feel the sort of the claustrophobia of being in this admittedly incredible house, but they're in that incredible house the whole time and completely isolated from everything around them. So I thought this was absolutely terrific. Apparently you can actually go stay in that house. Apparently it's a hotel. Mm-hmm. I will certainly be saving up to do that myself.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because
it's Norway, yeah.
The interview pieces almost feel like a sort of reverse Blade Runner, don't they? So instead of trying to find the machine in the person, they're trying to find the person in the machine. And it's a nice sort of interesting psychological study in that regard.
And Alex Garland, of course. So this is not in the sort of visceral nature of Dread or 28 Days Later.
No.
It's more like Never Let Me Go.
Yes.
I guess it's more of a companion piece to that.
Yeah, okay. Very much.
It's all about emotion and what it is to be human.
Fantastic. We love Alex Garland at this magazine, and you'll be delighted to know that he is going to be one of the guests on next week's podcast, which hasn't yet happened, but I'm reliably informed it will happen today. Indeed. So looking forward to that one. 4 stars then for Ex Machina.
Yes.
What would you say, honestly, a scale of the best Oscar Isaac performance this week? Best performance and then best film. Best Oscar Isaac performance.
Ooh.
To be honest, he has more to do, I would say, in A Most Violent Year. So just because
it's
of
his
that,
film. It's absolutely his film.
Just because of that, that's the best performance. But I would say Ex Machina is actually the better film.
All right, fantastic. 4 stars then for Ex Machina. And lastly, but not leastly this week, that's a phrase. We're going to talk about Mordecai. Just to set up very quickly, it's about Johnny Depp and his massive moustache. That's roughly it, Helen, isn't it?
Oh, God. I think you're a sadist to inflict this on people. Yes, he Charlie Mordecai, played by Johnny Depp.
Mordecai!
Has grown a horrendous moustache, which he's inordinately proud of. But he's also £8 million in debt to the Crown and has to find a way to pay it off to save his enormous manner, which immediately, you know, puts the viewer's sympathies right with him. I mean, who could, you know, resist rooting for a guy who's just trying to save an enormous, enormous country pile? So he's drawn into the theft of a Goya because he clearly has dodgy underworld leanings by MI5's Inspector Martland, who's played by Ewan McGregor. They went to college together in this. He's drawn in to find the lost Goya, but there's a complication, which is that it was once owned by one Goering, I think, and he may have written the code to his Swiss bank account on the back. So it's not just a Goya, it's also hundreds of millions of pounds of stolen gold. So everybody's after it. Gwyneth Paltrow plays Charlie's wife, who Ewan McGregor is after, and she's also then trying to help out her husband and find out the painting. Everyone is doing an accent in this film that is not their own. And after a while, I find that incredibly distracting. And the tone, you know, is going for sort of frothy, P.G. Woodhouse-esque.
High camp.
Not even camp necessarily, but just that really smart humour that, for a start, only ever really works on the page. You know, generally speaking, with the possible exception of Fry and Laurie, filmed P.G. Woodhouse has not worked particularly well. Mm-hmm. And this isn't as good as Woodhouse. It really isn't. I read the book over Christmas.
More like Woodshed.
Yes. It's a book by Kirill Bonfiglioli.
expertly navigated.
Sorry. And yeah, it, it, I just didn't... I didn't think the book worked because that sort of blithe tone doesn't sit well when people are actually dying. And actually, you know, being afflicted with grievous bodily harm and so on. So it's an odd sort of a mix, which didn't quite work for me on the page. And it really, really spectacularly didn't work on screen. Jokes just land there. Johnny Depp is so weird. You're genuinely meant to believe that Gwyneth Paltrow's apparently sane and quite nice woman would rather have him than Ewan McGregor's sane and nice cop. And that doesn't ring true for a minute. So I hated it. We gave that 2 stars. I think that's too many. I hated it.
Oh, come on now.
So you think this should have been our first no-star film?
Honestly, it would be right
this
up there.
This is your
for
Project
me.
X.
And there's great people in it. I mean, Paul Bettany is doing his best as the sort of thug sidekick to Johnny
Jock
Depp.
Jock Strap is his name,
yes. Unfortunately, Jeff Goldblum is in it for about 2 seconds. Olivia Munn is in it for about 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. It's a mess. It's a horrible, horrible mess.
2 stars then for Mordecai. It's not the film that I wanted to be when I saw the trailer.
Yes, it's not.
Which was a ludicrous Austin Powers-esque.
And that
romp.
Moment isn't even quite in it. He doesn't do the sneer. So
yeah.
So I sneered. I hope that helped.
Yeah. That's true. That's true. Such a shame. So then 2 stars for Mordecai, which is not a recommendation. What is a recommendation, of course, on the podcast is 3 stars, and that's what we've given to Rupert Wyatt's The Gambler, which Mark Wahlberg stars as an English professor who is struggling with a gambling addiction that he just cannot, or in fact will not, shake. It's a remake of the 1970s movie by James Toback. Do go and check it out. Mark Wahlberg is very, very good in it indeed. And also out this week is a documentary, Beyond Clueless, by Charlie Lyne, otherwise known as Ultra Culture, the guy who wrote that sort of film and pop culture blog. And it's an examination of the impact of teen movies over the years, with a narration by Fairuza Balk. And we gave that also 3 stars, which is a recommendation. So do go and check those out if they take your fancy. And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, when we'll be joined by, as I said, Alex Garland, writer-director of Ex Machina, and Paul Thomas Anderson, who'll be here to talk about his new movie, Inherent Vice. Until then, it's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from James.
Goodbye. I would like to point out that Alanis Morissette's Ironic is available on the 1995 album Jagged Little Pill, available now from Maverick Records.
Okay. And it's a goodbye from me. I'm off to shave my Mordecai mustache, which I've been growing for the last 6 months. Bit of a shame, that. See you next week. Bye.